This is Retromix After Hours.
A glorious sunny Thursday welcome to you. You are, of course, listening to the Rec Addicts After Hours Music and Technology Podcast. You have heard Ben. Pete shall appear soon, and we hope you're doing well. And we're going to wrap up Superbooth today, but that's not where we jump in at the beginning of our coddly pastly. We first have a weekly update, and there's stuff to update you, the listener, about. Pete, you're first. What have you been up to the past some days? Because I've already lost track of when I was last here.
Well, I went on my, I won't say mission, but I went on my little trip to Chichester.
Ah, yes, yes.
And it was very nice. It was glorious. Well, it's certainly glorious on the Saturday. The weather was not quite so glorious either side of that, but yes, a lot of cycling was to be done.
Oh, yes.
Was done.
How did it go? Was it fun?
Yes. There were some hills. We did have to get off and push an awful long way. And I was wearing Shimano shoes, which are...
Oh, your clips. Clipped in.
Well, I wasn't using cleats.
Ah, yeah.
I'd removed the actual cleats from the bottom of the shoes. There was no cleats on the pedals. But they're not exactly designed for walking in, are they?
Oh, no. They're a bit stiff.
Yes.
Because, oh, yeah, you need maximum power transfer.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to get off your bike. And, yeah, you get that creaking heel coming out of the heel cup situation.
Yes. But it was good. We cycled along a disused railway track called the Centurion Way.
Those are always good.
Yes. So that goes from Chichester, I would say a north sort of direction. And I like that sort of thing because it's relatively flat all the way.
Yep.
But we did tackle some hills and we did sort of crest over the South Downs.
Oh, yeah. Well, those can be some tough hills around there.
Yeah. There good was on a lot of walking and pushing at that stage, but I don't know what the altitude, I mean, it's not ridiculous, but the view is tremendous. You can see many miles right out into the Solent, almost over to the Isle of Wight and across.
Nice.
And then
one
on the other side, you can look down onto Goodwood Racetrack.
Cool.
Different. Anyway, I never really knew where Goodwood was. Not into horse racing, and I'm not really, I haven't been to the Goodwood speed thing they do the classic cars. But yes, it was a fine weekend. My legs stood up to it.
Awesome.
I don't think I've cycled in some years. I won't like to quote exactly how many years, but I haven't cycled in a long time. But yes, I came away relatively unscathed.
Nice one. Did you get your wonderful picture of a yellow field full of oilseed rape?
Alas, no. I did take some pictures, but we had slightly missed the flowering season. A lot of the oilseed rape had gone to seed. So it lost a lot of the
real
vivid
saturated.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did play around with a couple of lenses and took some shots, but I haven't even reviewed what I've got on the memory card. So that's
to be continued.
Good to be continued. But other than that, I did receive eventually the Dofer A111-6.
It's staring me in the face.
Yes.
Lovely. How do you like it? Do you like it?
I think it's everything that it was cracked up to be. And if you consider what the cost is, I know that Dofer is always relatively reasonably priced.
Yeah, how much was this one? How many bones?
I paid 159 Great British pounds for that. But considering that's a complete synth voice.
Yep, and a juicy one.
Yes, it does burble. You can get some sort of really nice round tones, or you can get some sort of quite throbby, gristly ones.
Awesome.
And it works really well at high and low frequencies.
A win all round.
Yes. Apart from adding some effects processing, which I have done with the Mimeophone, that's all it really needs. It's quite a little thing. Yeah, I was thinking that if you could get some sort of little Bijou sequencer to go with it, you could make a miniature little modular system.
Yeah, put it in a 4MS pod or something and take it around.
Yeah, literally just pop it under your arm or something. Pop it in a bag.
Put a little fashionable handbag situation. Take it to all of your synth meets, like the Modular Cafe.
Yes.
Google the Modular Cafe for me, just for a little plug. Why not?
Well, I'll be bringing that to the Modular Cafe at some point.
It's the 25th.
Next week.
Yes, indeed. Who have we got? New face Rod is bringing something Jupiter-flavoured for a bit of a demo. I think one of Akira's students might be cooking something up for us. Not sure. You'd be welcome to play something should you so desire as well.
I'll have to see.
Ooh, lovely stuff. That's going to be fun.
And that was it, really.
Awesome.
Cycling, sunshine, and modular.
Wonderful. Well, my update is quite similar, except without the modular, of course. Unfortunately, I survived Wales. Hooray! No injuries, apart from a couple of blisters from gripping the handlebars quite a lot out of fear. But no, it was cool. We got incredibly lucky with the weather. I'm sure you know Wales is famously unpredictable, but we had excellent sunshine on the first day, and it was really warm and only a tiny little shower on the second, and we only got dumped on the third day when we were at Bike Park Wales.
I see.
It was great.
How did you fare with a rented bike that you weren't possibly over familiar with before you met it?
The position is very different. So I ride a drop bar bike most of the time, in fact all of the time if it's my bike. So my hands are, what, 40 centimetres apart most of the time? And then going onto this big old chunky burly off-road machine where they were more like a metre apart and you sit way more upright, and it was odd. I think I got used to it after about the first half of the first day. Other than that, it was fine. There weren't any, I'm not a connoisseur of mountain bikes, but I didn't spot any issues. I rented two different ones, and they kept me safe and alive and having fun. So, full marks! Yeah, that was cool. A lot of really technical climbing, which might have been my favourite part, even though it was also really tiring. Type 2 fun, I suppose. So going up a mountainside on really chunky, weirdly angled rocks and things.
Well, that's what I was going to ask when you say technical climbing. You're sort of climbing a quite steep angle on a very uneven surface, I
exactly.
would assume you mean.
That's the stuff. Lumpy, weirdly shaped and steep with switchbacks and all that. It was cool.
So how high did you go?
I don't know how high we were at various points, but one ride had 1,650 feet of elevation gain in it. Yeah, that was a big one. Definitely recommend it.
Did you find yourself having to get off and push at all, or was it all
no
brute force?
I managed to get through the whole thing. There were three of us, Ant from the ModCaf on a standard analog bike, just like me, and Scott, who was on his e-bike. And he was actually saying it was quite interesting. You have to really adapt the way you're cycling uphill because of the way they deliver power. Because if you're in a really low gear and you're trying to get up a steep bit and you give it too many beans, you'll just go do a wheelie and go straight over the back. So yeah, cool stuff.
Was it the type with a Bosch engine in it?
Yeah, it was a really good Bosch thing in the cranks.
Yeah.
And a big old battery.
I believe those are the ones that you should choose, not the hub motor ones.
Yeah, I think hubs are fine for like a flat commuting type situation. But yeah, if you want the good stuff in the bottom bracket area. So that was that. Mountain biking, I survived. It was cool. The other part, the next bit of updatage shall be in the film camera world. I have ascended to medium format with a camera that I think is from 1957, maybe. I'm not sure the exact date, but that's kind of when these were around.
Has it got a date secreted inside somewhere, possibly?
Not that I could see. I do have a serial number, so I'm sure some guy on the internet has a list of rough serial number dates that I could look up. But this is a Yashica Matte, which is a TLR, which came at some point after the legendary Rolleiflex. So if you're not a camera person, you may still have heard of a DSLR or an SLR, which is single lens reflex. So one lens, little mirror thing that bounces the light up into your eyeball so you can see what you're shooting. A TLR is a twin lens reflex camera, and there is one lens on the bottom, which is the one that takes the pictures and stuff, and there is a lens on the top, which is the one that you look through, and the flex in Rolleiflex is because there's a 45 degree mirror that reflects it up to a waist level viewfinder, and it's quite interesting looking through the focusing screen rather than sort of an eyepiece. I will hand this over to you in a second, Pete, so you can wave it around and have a look, because it's quite odd. But yes, this will take 120 millimeter film. Is it millimeter? Either way, 120 film, which you can actually buy affordable color stocks in, unlike 35mm, and it does make a glorious sound, which of course I've recorded alongside my other cameras. So I'm going to play these for you, and it will first be my Yashica Matte, then the Olympus OM10, and then my Canon Demi half frame. Have a listen. There we go. Excuse the reverb and the noise. My home is not a great recording environment. But yeah, Pete, have a wave around of this. It's quite interesting.
It's definitely got that straight out some 1950s film.
Yeah, they're an interesting look. So the confusing part when you're trying to compose your shot is, if you're looking through the waist level finder, because of that 45 degree mirror, everything's kind of reversed. So if you're going, oh, actually, let me just move to the left, you've probably gone the wrong way. But take a little bit of getting used to, but that's going to come with me to Scotland. Tomorrow, actually, we're leaving. And I've got one roll of Kodak Gold 200. That'll be my colour film.
It's quite a weight to that thing.
It's chunkier than I expected. Reassuringly so, hopefully. So yes, Kodak Gold 200, which is a very budget-friendly film that you can actually buy, which is nice, because the other option that you can at the moment is sort of the Portra 160, 400, 800, which is very expensive. So yes, that will be my colour film, and I think my favourite black and white at the moment, not that I have a huge level of experience, is Ilford FP4 Plus. I've got a couple of rolls of that for my black and white, and it's quite contrasty and makes some nice dynamic images.
So with the two lenses, I assume there's a sort of some sort of focus mechanism, is it? Those wheels adjacent to the two lenses, by any chance?
Yeah, let me just...
And is it a case that they focus together simultaneously?
Yes, so focus is over here on the side, and if you watch the whole plate...
Oh, I see, they all move together.
Indeed, so that's how that one works. So I think, what have I got? I have f3.5 to 22. Obviously that only controls the taking lens, and the viewing lens just sits at 3.5, I think, but they're the same focal length, 80 millimeters, but it's not the same as 80 millimeters on a 35mm camera
because the film's a different size.
Exactly, so I don't know what the equivalent is. Let's find out, shall we? 80mm on a Mamiya TLR is somewhere in the region of a 40mm. So wide-ish, maybe. But we'll find out. This particular camera is a 6x6, which means I'll get 12 images in square format, which I've not really... I'm not an Instagram person, really, so I've not really composed on that shape before. But a bit of advice I saw on the internet was, just think in the back of your mind, would this look good as an album cover? And hopefully that will lead to some good images. Of course, I shall update you when that happens. But you can see if you open up the back of the camera, that's your little square where the film will be. So it's quite a sizable negative to be working with.
Yep, it certainly is a large chunk of film in there.
Hopefully for lots of detail.
So if it's not a rude question, how much does one of those set you back these days?
That particular one, because it's one that was produced in quite huge quantities for about 16 years, or so my research tells me, that one was about £80 and had been recently CLA'd, or cleaned, lubricated and adjusted, apparently. So that's very reasonable. The more desirable models, like the Rolly Flex, which I think was kind of the flagship from the company that made the Rolly Flex cameras before it was just Rolly. Anyway, those would be sort of £300 upwards. So the entry-level stuff, sort of, yeah, £80 to £150 kind of pounds, that sort of your area. And of course, sky's the limit, as always is with these things.
Yeah, but it's not a horrendous barrier to step into it if the camera body itself only costs £80. I know that there's still film purchasing and developing, but it is not sort of completely out of people's reach. It's something that you can definitely aspire to.
Yeah, it's the same price as my SLR, the Olympus. So I'm happy in that range, because it's not, as you say, it's not outlandish. And another good thing is, because the lens is, I think you can swap them, maybe, but it's really not the point. You get what you get. And those are the lenses you have, so there's less of a collectory type thing.
It's more about positioning yourself to get the shot you want rather than trying to pull the shot with the lens.
Yeah, I'm quite looking forward to it. We should take it outside afterwards, because it's quite something looking through the viewfinder and sort of seeing the image there. It's really different. Anyway, those are the weekly updates, and I did mention before, Superbooth is done and dusted, and we need to round things up. Pete, do you have any highlights that you'd like to do? Because I've got kind of the last bits that I thought were worthy of mention. I haven't really picked any favourites yet, because I haven't really dug into many demos.
I did peruse a number of videos, mainly the Sonic State ones, and there were many things that we've already covered in the last two podcasts. Mm-hmm. Sort of had already been previously pre-announced, pre-trade show, so to speak. I tried to home in on things that looked unusual. There's one I can certainly speak to, and I have to wait and see what they're going to release, but they did an interview with DinSync in respect to his recreations or his... They're not copies. He used some terminology, but they look pretty similar of the 808, the 909, and...
Did another 303 as well?
Yes. Yeah. I think he did the 303 first. And has he done one of those SH202? Is there a 202 or is it an MC202?
I think it would be an MC if it's a 2.
Possibly. Anyway, he was forecasting they're going to do a complete SH101.
Ooh.
And the gist I got was that you can buy as many or little parts as you want. So he was demonstrating an SH101 that was an original case body, but the electronics had been swapped out.
I think I see where you're going there.
Yes, so I was sort of interested. I haven't seen any prices yet, and there's nothing on the DinSync website to look at. So when it's there, I'll have a look and weigh up whether it's worth getting a sort of new set of boards and I can do a gut swap on my one. Or do I persevere and try and continue repairing it? I think
you,
I know...
You did spend a good amount of time on it. You did make some progress.
Yes. I mean, it makes noise. Mm. It's just, I believe I am down to the controller chip.
Right.
Which there is quite a good mod that you can buy, which not only replaces the controller chip, but gives you MIDI as well.
Yes, right.
Unfortunately, it's £200 for the chip kit.
Is that just for a single little doobry that I've forgotten the name for?
Yeah.
Just that. Yeah. 200. Oof.
Well, I think there's a few other little components. There's some slight power adjustment that needs to be made to it. But other than that, yes, that's it. So I haven't taken it any further.
It's a good chunk of money, that one.
It'd be nice to get it working again. Mm. But I've got other things that do the same job. So I'm not fussed. I mean, I keep that particular unit because there's nostalgic connotations to it.
Definitely.
I've got a lot of history. In fact, I believe it's the second oldest synth I own.
What is the oldest?
The oldest would be the Korg Lander.
Ah, yes, of course. Is that still over there in the pile?
Yes, it is. And then the SH-101, I've mostly mentioned this before, but my mother bought it for my 21st birthday in 1982 when they were just released.
Yeah, not a bad 21st birthday present, that one.
Yes, so it's managed to sort of survive all the last 40 years.
Mm.
40 years. When you actually say it out loud, it's a bit shocking, really, isn't it?
It's nearly twice as old as me. Oh, man.
So that was interesting. But the one that stuck out for me was the Eventide sequencer.
Oh, cool. Yeah, do jump in on that. I've got that flagged here, but I will take it off so you can get in there.
It's called a Misha, isn't it?
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so for that, that had a sort of frisson of the NDLR, the Noodler, about it.
Mm.
I mean, I'm sure it's not quite the same, but it's got a kind of circle of fifths thing kind of going on, or semitones in a little kind of OLED-y thing in the center.
So it certainly looks interesting.
Gives me the impression it's going to be a lot more melodious and musical than a lot of Eurorack sequencers.
Yeah.
The only stumbling block was the price.
I haven't looked. I'm going to guess $450/pounds.
You're slightly short.
Oh, no.
So bear with me. Let me tell you what it costs. So, right, are you ready for this?
Braced, ready.
Right, $599.
That's a lot of cash.
Yes.
Better be good for that one. You're going to want to try it first. If you can. We'll have a good returns policy.
Yes, that's the problem. Well, we'll certainly have them in the store because we we do sell Eventide. So I suspect that we will have one of these available. So I will be quite keen to get one on display so I can play with it.
Yeah, nice one.
But yes, I'm always a sucker for novel sequences in Eurorack and, you know, potentially have the sort of standard ways things are sequenced where there's just gates, triggers, maybe there's some pitch control.
Yeah.
Maybe. But ones that are definitive or different, like the
SIG. We can just call it the SIG.
The SIG.
Just to keep it short.
Yeah. Mm. The Stochastic Inspiration Generator, or the Ramona one that I had.
The Melodicer.
The Melodicer, which was effectively the same thing. And then you get completely odd ones like the Turing Machine, which is different in a completely other way.
Mm-hmm.
Or what was the blue one with the rotating lights?
Euclidean Circles.
That's the one.
My personal favourite because it's so pretty.
There's all sorts of methods, but I always want something that sounds a bit more human. Not so sort of robotic or...
Yeah, or keep an eye on it. Have you seen any demos yet?
Well, I saw the Sonic State one, and they were sort of prodding it when they wanted to change key. I wondered if you have to do some initial tuning or somehow it pushes the right semitone to your oscillator, but I'm not quite sure how that would be because you've still got to tune the oscillator.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to keep everything really solidly in tune, I think you'd have to tune up first and then go from there.
Just make sure you know what note it's supposed to be spitting out and then tune, something like that.
I suppose it's fine if you use one of these these oscillators where it displays what semitone it's sitting on, like the tip-top audio ones.
Yeah, and does Braids do that as well? Because it's got a screen for it. Or is that just the mode that it's using, the old Braids?
I don't actually know. Yeah, so...
Well, pricey.
Yeah, but it was interesting anyway. And I have to say, was Superbooth late last year, or has a year gone past so quickly?
It feels a bit quick. It wouldn't surprise me if it was delayed due to COVID-related things, as so much stuff was.
It just seems that it wasn't so many episodes ago that we were talking about last year's Superbooth and some of the things that are on there, because there was that one with the flying faders.
Yeah, no, that was super cool. Yeah, that's Der Mann mit der Maschine system, I think.
But it doesn't seem a year ago that we were talking about that.
Well, you know, COVID made time not real, so it could have been a year ago. Who knows?
Other than that, the problem being is so many of the products that were shown in various videos were ones that, as I say, we already discussed in previous
leaks and teasers and things.
And then the ones I always switch off very quickly are when they are prototypes and they're nowhere near production. So one, for a start, you don't know when it's ever going to surface or if it's ever going to surface.
Yeah.
Because that certainly happens quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Ergo, the Expressive E...
Osmos.
We still wait. What, we 2.5 years?
I think I remember checking this like a few episodes ago. Last time we were going, when did they announce it? Let's find out.
I looked at it the other day and it just said, available soon.
Mm.
It never seems to change. So I don't know what problems they're facing. I would imagine that all the issues that are compounding on top of each other and affecting all the other manufacturers have sort of struck them down somewhat.
This November will be the 3rd anniversary of not having it after it being announced and demoed by Cuckoo anyway.
Yes. And I've seen this thing before. Again, I always cite the Eurorack modules that Tom Oberheim was demonstrating at various trade shows a good 4, maybe 5 years ago plus. And they just never appeared. Or Tip Top Audio a few shows ago, it was definitely a Superbooth, but it was a few years back, were demonstrating some stuff they'd done in collaboration with Surge. And
I don't know that.
Believe any of that appeared.
Interesting. Yeah.
So they had fully working prototypes, but
I just don't recall
a product ever surfacing.
Yeah, interesting.
So who knows what happens, whether politics intervenes or something like that, and they fall out with the people they're collaborating with, or they just can't quite get the product over the line. I'm sure there's a myriad of reasons why these things happen, but so many of these products seem to fall at the first or second or third hurdle.
Shame.
Consequently, they never get to retail.
Right. On the Superbooth train, we shall endeavour to update you on the last few headlines. Now, I'm going to start with the Eurorack module corner of the world. One that's pretty cool and, well, it's not the most glamorous module in the world, but I think it's brilliant. And of course, it's Bafaco again. Those wonderful chaps from Spain. We have the 4x4 audio interface. What do they call it? AC/DC. Ha! Amazing. Who knows if they'll get sued for that. But it is a 4x4 audio interface over USB based on... Now, what's the protocol, the thing? It's the Rebel Technology Zybeka firmware and hardware platform. So you get 4 channels of 16-bit 48 kilohertz audio quality, and you have gain controls on your inputs to your computer. So previously you'd have to shell out a decent chunk of money to expert sleepers to have something like this in your rack, or just go 3.5mm to 1/4-inch cables and chuck it into a normal audio interface. But I think this is super cool, and it's only 170 euros probably, or pounds, for the DIY version. Top stuff, Bafaco, we love it. Qubit, another brand that we quite like, have a new spectral reverb, which is based on a phase vocoder engine, and it sounds squishy and vast, and also quite metallic and strange if you want it to. But that's a cool option if you're looking for a weird reverb. I always do like my weird reverbs. That's Qubit Aurora Spectral Reverb.
Did you see any of the stuff about the Dreadbox kits that are coming out?
Oh, we're getting there. Don't you worry. I have 3 Dreadbox things to talk about, but they're in the, even though some of them are Eurorack-ish, they're in the non-Eurorack category for now.
I shall wait.
I'm excited about those. Cool. Endorphins, a couple of little cool things. We've got Running Order and Airstreamer, which is, well, they're 1U. They are both 1U modules. You have a 2-track trigger sequencer and Euclidean generator. That's your running order. And hang on. Yep, Airstreamer is a regular 3U, and that's just an envelope kind of boy.
Because the running order is a 3U module. They've just made it into a 1U version.
Made it horizontal. The more stuff in 1U, the more flexible you can be if you happen to have an IntelliGel case. That's kind of fun. Bastl Instruments have a Eurorack module called Pizza, which is a digital oscillator, and they say it has extra jalapenos in it, which is, interesting. It's a digital wave-shaping FM situation and makes some pretty gnarly sounds, so go and find a demo about that. There's lots of stuff on YouTube if that might be your cup of tea. There is a sequencer from Busy Circuits, the old ALM, in the wild, which I think might have been teased a million years ago and then suddenly resurfaced. They haven't made an announcement as far as I know, but it's a cool looking thing. It's the ASQ1, which is a couple of channels, but what intrigues me is the keyboard style clickety clackety one octave keyboard on it. Keep an eye on that if you're into your sequencers. And another Endorphins one, but this is a collaboration with Andrew Huang. Have you seen this one?
I did see, but I can't remember. But I remember the reference to Andrew.
Yes, indeed. So this is a quite cramped and dense and powerful looking digital module. We're talking 96 kilohertz, 32-bit internal with oversampling capability, but you've got quite a lot of stuff in here. You've got stereo processing for all of these, delay, reverb, filtering, and distortion. Oversampling in the distortion, that's where that's coming in, and it's pretty powerful looking. I haven't checked out the demos, but I'll be interested to see. I think this is the first bit of sort of Andrew Huang signature gear, for want of a better word.
Does seem to be a bit of a thing where these, how shall I call them, commentators, of turning their hand to collaborating on actual modules.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, DivKid have done quite a few with more than one manufacturer, I believe.
Bafaco a couple of times, Instruo once. That might be it, just those two. The two great manufacturers that we do like.
The other thing I noticed about this year's show, there was a lot of people showing things that weren't actually new. They might have had a firmware update or something like that, and they were just reiterating, yes, this we make this and it's available, and we've updated the firmware. And there was quite a few of those, which are interesting if you're considering buying that particular product or you already have one, but it wasn't
earth-shattering.
Not much of a revelation other than that.
Yeah, a little bit annoying when that happens. So that Andrew Huang module is called Ghost. Go and have a look if you like it. And talking of Instruo, kind of utilitarian but no less interesting modules, we have an input and output. And I'm not going to try and pronounce the names because they're probably Gaelic-ish and very confusing. But on the input module, you've got quite a lot of stuff. You've got a stereo in to dual Eurorack level bit. You have a condenser microphone built in, envelope following stuff. And it's about everything you could possibly want from an input module, including pedals in foot pedal interfacing. And then you've got a stereo output with headphones, simple stuff, but it's Instruo, so it looks amazing, and hopefully will sound and work fantastically. Tip Top Audio are continuing their Buchla thing with the sequential voltage source and dual voltage processor. Those are coming this summer, and we've heard good things about the Buchla Tip Top stuff, so do enjoy that.
I think it's a very good option because Tip Top Audio stuff is very well built.
And Buchla is horrifyingly out of reach for everybody.
Or most people.
Yeah.
Plus the fact this is completely bona fide by Buchla themselves. So
yes, indeed.
It's as Buchla-y as you can get without buying a Buchla.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I know a lot of people just look at it and go, ooh, I really want to just have all of them and make a mini Buchla myself.
Yeah, I might to start purchasing soon.
Dangerous.
The other thing I did notice about this year's show, and I suppose it's a theme that's going to be more and more, there's a lot of people producing modules that kind of do things that plenty of other modules do. You know, then there's quite a lot of reinventing the wheel going on.
It is always quite annoying where a manufacturer that you really like, for example, some of those Endorphins ones, or I think Shackmat kind of did this a little bit, you just go, oh, cool, it's a VCO, VCF, VCA. Oh, there's lots of those. Or, some envelopes.
Yeah.
Cool story, bro. Yeah.
It just seemed to be a lot of it. I was sort of going onto videos and 5 minutes in, I was going, boring.
Yeah. I think occasionally some of it might be the brand maybe has a bigger vision for making their own complete system. So they go, oh, actually, we better knock out the other elements to make a complete system, and we might as well offer them as an individual module first so we can test them in isolation before we make one giant system, potentially.
Yes.
Maybe they're doing that.
I can only imagine they're going to either appeal to people who are completists and they want everything that manufacturer makes.
Yeah.
There's plenty of guys and girls out there that are like that.
Well, yeah, you have your wonderful old-school Pittsburgh row in the Moth.
Yes, I still haven't got everything they ever made.
Yeah.
And now I'm kicking myself because you can't get it anymore.
Yeah, rare stuff, well, if any exists at all.
There's a few bits and pieces, but I quite often look and I don't see them coming up secondhand. Yeah. Very often, anyway. I wanted to get a Crush.
Oh, yeah. No, I've seen that one on the old modular grid a couple of times.
And they did a little sequencer that was kind of like a little Game Boy.
Yeah, it was the game system, I think it was called.
And then there was there a Wavetable Oscillator? Possibly.
Not
there's
too
a
sure.
couple of other bits and pieces. Anyway, there's a few bits and pieces in that range that I might still try to acquire, but I've kind of got out of my collecting phase. I'm more into the functional phase now. You know, what does it actually sound like rather than got to collect them all?
Yeah. Another one for difficult words to pronounce is Earwave. That's easy. That's the easy part. Collaborating with Toolscorn. Scott Scorn. Toolscorn. 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 Touellscoun. You know them. You've probably pronounced them in some way in your head and have no idea how it's supposed to be, but there we go. And I think they also collaborated with Yann Tiersen, who is a French composer who seems to be relatively famous, not somebody I've heard of before, but those three powerhouses have created a complete semi-modular desktop Boyo, which is, well, is from some left-field manufacturers, so it is actually quite interesting. You can have that in desktop or Eurorack mode. Now, let me tell you what you get. You have four analog oscillators with different modes, analog filter, five VCAs and an audio input, and you get a digital noise generator envelope, two envelopes in fact, a delay and a polyphonic sequencer. But because we're talking Toolscorn, or however on earth you want to pronounce it, there is grunge and grit and interesting weirdness. Check out the demo. It's kind of cool.
I did notice that the Soma Lab Terra was fully on display.
Oh, the weird wooden thing that we were being annoyed about last episode.
Yes, and the gentleman who was representing Soma Labs at the show was pretty confident that supplies would be available later this year. So I'm not quite sure how that is being facilitated, but sounds good. And he also said the price wasn't that perturbing. I can't remember exactly what he quoted, but it was a lot.
For those who want it, good news.
Yeah, it was a lot less expensive than one would possibly imagine a big hunk of wood costing.
Okay, before we get to the stuff that we're actually excited about, Dreadbox, let's mention that the OP1 has been refreshed.
In what way, exactly, apart from the silver rim?
Well, it's thinner, because that's what everyone wanted.
Really?
Yeah, they're doing that Apple thing. They're like, oh, it's so much thinner. The screen is bigger. And actually, everybody just wanted it to be more durable and have more battery life. Anyway, that's iPhone rants aside, but so there's the OP1 Field, is what they've called it. So, let me give you some headlines.
Go on.
Louder sound over the speaker system.
Ooh.
Great, nobody used it with that anyway. Bluetooth MIDI, USB-C is a connector, cool. Actually, I think the MIDI in and out is quite a big deal for the big fans of it, because I think it was a bit of a pain to do it.
Is there going to be a latency problem with Bluetooth MIDI?
It's not too terrible these days, but yes, there will be latency. You know, what we're on Bluetooth 6, or I don't know what version we're on, but it is getting better. The whole signal chain is supposedly 32-bit in there, and you can have multiple tapes and different formats, recording formats, in the kind of tape recorder section. 24 hours of battery life, which I don't know how long the original one lasted, but that's fine, I guess. There is a new reverb, a new synth engine, and FM broadcasting, which I think you could only pick up the radio before. There's an upgraded screen, yay! And the graphics are different, yay!
And the prices, I've seen the price.
Let me just see if there's anything else to actually tell you about with. Supposedly, there's 100 new features, but if you look on the website where they have the huge list, nothing is that exciting. And are you ready, Pete? Do you want to give our audience the big old headline number that they may well have already heard and seen?
Yes.
Lay it on us. How bad is it? Given that the original was £799 back in the good old days.
I saw 1,999 euros.
Which means $1,999 and pounds. And
I just can't imagine who is going to buy one of these at this price. I mean, when we had that other price hike, when they couldn't get the chips.
Yeah, what was that? Over to about 1,099?
Something like that, 1,200.
Yeah.
Yeah, big jump. I mean, we hardly ever sell these anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's their answer? Here's another one that's even more expensive.
Yeah, we're just going to double the price almost. Hooray.
I just think, I mean, I know that it's a sort of marvel of technology and it can do, it's like a recording studio literally in your pocket or certainly in your rucksack, possibly. But it's a serious amount of money. It's a major chunk of cash for something that's, I'm not going to call it a toy, but it's got a toyish element to it.
Yeah. I'm on the Teenage Engineering website because that's always a hilarious place to live. They have accessories, of course. There is a leather wrap that you can buy for the OP1 field, and it is expensive. Let me describe it to you. It's white, and it's essentially, it's just a square that sort of folds over the back and the front and has some holes for the knobs, so it doesn't even protect them. It's got kind of a microfiber inside, white on the outside. Place your bets. In British pounds, how many pennies is that going to be?
£300.
Actually, yeah, not too far off. It's 249. But that's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, for a little leatherette. And I suspect it's not real leather.
Who knows? Let's see if they say.
I mean, it's going to offend all the people who don't like animal products.
Well, they're claiming it to be actual leather. Cut from one piece, all leather is sourced as byproduct of the European meat and farming industry. Soft calf skin backed with suede.
That's certainly not going to encourage any of the vegans out there.
No. Right, I'm going to see if I can find that big list and read you some of the 100 features that really aren't very exciting. The new speaker has a passive radiator. Wow. For those who don't know, a passive radiator is a different method of porting in a way of kind of increasing the low frequency response without the unwanted side effects of port noise. And supposedly it's a bit flatter. It's something that Amphion and, you know, those wooden studio monitors, those French ones? Who are they? You know the ones.
Focal.
Focal, yes. In their Shape series, they have passive radiators, but there's a very small one in the OP1 field, if you care. It's slimmer. That's one feature they really like to. Wow. It's got Velcro on it. That's a feature.
Yeah, you're certainly not selling it to me.
No, let me try harder. Over 160 minutes of sample storage.
What did it have previously?
Probably less, I assume.
I mean, it wouldn't be so bad if they brought it out and it was the same price.
Mm. There's a built-in user guide.
What, on that little screen?
Mm. Adjustable pitch bend range. Now we're talking.
But most of this is all software.
There's a charge power status LED. What luxury. Ooh, the power switch is ergonomic. There's a new font. No way! You're really pushing the boat out here.
And that, they've described the new font as one of the major
Of the major 100 features that they've changed. Ooh, the packaging is different. How innovative. The metronome sound has changed.
I really am not feeling that extra £800 of value.
Well, you might feel it now because they include a printed manual.
Ooh.
There's a QR code as well. That's a separate feature, the QR code is, by the way. Ooh, there is a control for the brightness of the screen. That's pretty serious stuff. Ooh, and the user can rename their own patches. Groundbreaking.
Yes. Well, I'm majorly underwhelmed with all of that.
So, to news we actually care about, Dreadbox! A wonderful, amazing, lovely bunch of synthy people from Athens, I believe. We have some kits to talk about. Now, did we mention the demise of the Erebus and the Nix and stuff?
I think we might have mentioned it in the past. I can't recall.
Mm. Good news, almost. Unfortunately, the Nix isn't coming back yet. But there are DIY kits for both the Hades, a surprise return, and the Erebus. Not the little Erebus that they did a while ago, but the Erebus.
The Mark II.
Mm, yes, indeed. The good one doesn't have the wooden end cheeks. But who cares? It's DIY, which means it's kind of cheaper.
Is it this one almost Eurorack mountable as well?
I think they all are. Yeah, give me a sec. Let me verify that. Yes, indeed. I think they come with the little desktop box but they are Eurorackable.
I'm quite interested in building one of these. Mm. I am not sure whether that you're going to have to go directly to Dreadbox to buy them or whether Thonk will stock them. They're not listed anywhere at this time. They're not on the Dreadbox
You've already
site.
Had a look.
Yes.
Gotcha.
I thought, oh, Erebus. Mm. Oh, I wouldn't mind purchasing and building one of those.
Yeah, and the Hades also, that's a bass synthesizer if you haven't met it before, but really warm and juicy. I have heard demos of the original.
They were trying to nudge them in the Sonic State video that I watched and inquiring whether there was any chance that they would put the Abyss out as a kit.
I've already forgotten the Abyss. That was the four-voice poly that I really liked.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, please, it was so cool. But on that note, have you heard the leaks?
Go on. Leak away.
I will. That sounds weird. I will leak away. There are rumours of a new polysynth from them, but it is Murmux flavoured, which is actually one of their older synths, the Murmux. I don't really know too much about it. Okay, so let's do some Murmux history, because I found it right here. It was a bass synthesizer from 2014, and this is the one that I'm pretty sure I've mentioned on the podcast before, as existing occasionally as a sort of floor unit with really lovely wooden bass pedals and sort of tweed wrapping, and it's the coolest thing. There was also a four-voice paraphonic version, and it appears that this new one may be even eight voices, and there is a front panel that we can look at here. Let me read you some stuff. I see on the left two VCOs with many waveforms. We also have an interesting mix control between those, which going clockwise, you have off, 1, 1 and 2, 1 and 2 plus N, 2 plus N and N. What is N? Can I find anything about N? No. Interesting. Maybe that's some kind of modulated version of the two. We then have two modulation controls between LFO and envelope for each of the oscillators separately. There is a detune and glide control at the bottom. In the filter section, we've got cutoff, envelope, LFO, resonance. Ooh, interesting. A bass boost and cut control. That's kind of interesting. And also FM from VCO2 or noise, and what appears to be a button for key tracking. You then have an envelope for the filter, just to its right on the bottom, amplifier, envelope, master control up the top with a spread control. Maybe that's a bit of stereo spread. That's quite nice. A BBD, so that sounds delayish to me, with an amount, and a morph control, which has resonator on one side and, ensemble on the other. That's fun. And then underneath it, you've got a delay. So if the top one's BBD, maybe the delay will be a digital rather than analog, but you've got mix, time, and feed back on there. You then have, on the right, a space for a little display, probably a clicky encoder, which says menu/enter. You then have load, save, and back. Awesome. We've got presets. There is then a polyphonic LFO, which has a rate control, a spread control, which is detune on the left, track on the right, a wave button, and a fade control, which is out and in. Not too sure what that's all about. There is LFOB with rate, amount, target and wave, and the amount is just positive and negative. And my guess is this will be it'll be bigger than the, what's the sort of Juno-ish polysynth they've got that I can't remember the name of?
The Nymphs.
Yes, that one. I think it's gonna be bigger than that, but not too massive. This is a desktop unit, by the way.
Well, the Nymphs is particularly small when you see one in the flesh.
Yeah, I've not met one in the flesh, but that's the panel.
This is the panel that everyone was getting excited about the show, because it was on someone else's stand, wasn't it? That someone that did front panels.
Exactly. It looks pretty cool. The booth that it was at is the Grauert. Grauert? I don't know. But yeah, a panel manufacturer indeed. And it looks cool. But yeah, it doesn't actually say Dreadbox on the panel, but Murmux is obviously a Dreadbox thing. The last bit of Dreadbox news is a new design, the Dysmetria, which sounds a lot like the names from their Chromatic line, but this is an analog groove synthesizer. I don't know that we've got any demos yet, and I don't really know too much about it, but you have a sequencer, an oscillators section, mixer, amplifier, filter, and some stuff. So maybe this is kind of heading slightly into the corner occupied, not exclusively, but dominantly by the Moog, The DFAM.
Yeah.
That is occupied by the Moog DFAM, or the Moog DFAM if you prefer. There we go. Superbooth is over. There's stuff to chew on. I do insist that you go and find some demos of any of the stuff that we've mentioned, because I'm not going to play those YouTube videos for you on a podcast when YouTube exists. Go and find it and enjoy. And let us know on Facebook or Instagram at RackAddictsUK what your favourite announcement was. Rufus, if you're listening, David, if you're listening, do let me know. I want to know what you're interested in from this wonderful trade show. Well, hey, we've made it. It's the end of the podcast. Thank you, of course, because everybody has listened to the end. Thank you. Yeah, you in particular. You in the bath. Done that one before. Right, we must round it off with our miscellaneous multimedia recommendation that isn't delivered on a Monday this week. Right, cool, I've got one if you're...
Yeah, you go ahead, you go ahead.
So, I shall begin with a filmy thing. Right, I will say right now, I'm not a big film buff. I don't go to the cinema very often. In fact, the last time I have, I think I've been maybe twice in the last 4 years... 5 years, and that was just to see Dune. And speaking of Dune, and also Arrival, I finally understood why some film buffs go, oh, this director, oh, the director's amazing, my favourite director this, whoever. I had previously gone, who, what, who's that famous person that everybody seems to know that I don't know at all? I saw Dune, and of course was blown away, like everybody else, because it was brilliant, and my colleague from work said, he was talking about it, and then he was mentioning the director, of course, whose name has evaporated from my brain again. Damn.
Which films?
Dune, Arrival.
Villeneuve.
Oh, yes. My colleague at work was saying, oh, yes, Denis Villeneuve, what a guy! And then he connected the dots for me in my brain. Arrival was awesome and original and brilliant. And then, after seeing Dune, they were the same guy. Oh, so many things suddenly made sense to me. Then I stumbled across this YouTube video from the channel, Every Frame a Painting. Does that ring a bell for you, Pete?
Every Frame a Painting?
No.
What the phrase?
I don't know, but I was just hoping you hadn't mentioned it before. I hadn't. We're all good.
No.
So this is Edgar Wright, How to Do Visual Comedy. So this is kind of an analytical, film buffy type channel talking about Edgar Wright's stuff and why he's so good at visual comedy. Films such as Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, World's End, and other ones. Those are the three that I know best. But it was really interesting learning a bit about the impact a director can have and what Edgar Wright does, and I do really enjoy his films. So I do recommend you check this one out. Every Frame a Painting, and the video is Edgar Wright, How to Do Visual Comedy. It's the good stuff. And I'm sure you'll find more on that channel that you enjoy if you're a film person. Pete, what have you got for us?
Right, surprise, surprise, back to YouTube for me this week. In the past, I have recommended such YouTube channels as Jules Guide. Jules is a tour guide in London and does sort of tour guide-ish kind of videos.
So I remember, yes.
Sort of strides around the place in his straw boater and blazer and points at things and talks about the history and comes up with interesting things. And there are quite a few of these kind of slightly esoteric, possibly, channels that seem to feature on London. Being a large metropolis, there's a lot, and there's a lot of history.
Yeah.
And this is another one. This one's called Rob's London.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob just points out various novelties and bits and pieces and fleshes out a story. So there was one like London's Smallest House.
Oh, yeah.
And another one called London's High-Rise Stables.
Yep.
And another one entitled Who Was the Titanic Newsboy? It's that famous photograph with the boy that says Titanic Disaster, Great Loss of Life.
Mm.
So, yeah, so he digs up these little kind of nuggets of factoids.
Yeah.
And does a video. Again, they're easy to watch. They all seem to run from between 10 to 20 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And they are worth a watch, especially if you're either planning a trip to London or you are particularly interested in London, London history, London landmarks, etc., etc.
Awesome.
So that is my multimedia recommendation for this week. It is the YouTube channel Rob's London, all one word.
Lovely stuff. Thank you, as always, for listening to episode 124 of Rack Addicts After Hours. I will be speaking to you again the other side of Scotland, and I hope to update you. But please tune in. Farewell.